Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, sitting in for Ben Kiefer while he's out recovering from knee surgery. And it's Politics Day on this Wednesday. And we have plenty of news, as usual, to get through over the course of the hour. And joining us to analyze the news, Jonathan Haseed is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Ben.
And Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Thank you, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. Well, President Trump did announce that the U.S. will be pulling out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That's usually called the Iran Nuclear Agreement. And he says that deal is rotten and that it's got glaring flaws.
Over the past few months, we have engaged extensively with our allies and partners around the world, including France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. We have also consulted with our friends from across the Middle East. We are unified in our understanding of the threat and in our conviction that Iran must never acquire a nuclear weapon. After these consultations, it is clear to me that we cannot prevent an Iranian nuclear bomb under the decaying and rotten structure of the current agreement. The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen.
And before the president made that announcement, former Secretary of State John Kerry spoke with CNN urging the president not to pull out of the agreement.
I think the best thing the president could do is use this agreement, staying in the agreement, and then focus on the missiles and the other things with some sort of a deadline. But to pull out of it and try to focus on those things totally complicates your ability to achieve the goals. And I think it could actually lead to conflict potentially.
And John Kerry there, who was Secretary of State at the time that this deal was moving through, of course, under President Obama. And let's listen back to President Obama audio from 2015 announcing that 2 years of negotiations with Iran was ending and reaching that nuclear deal. And during his address to the country, Obama talked about what it would look like if the deal had not been reached.
Consider what happens in a world without this deal. Without this deal, there is no scenario where the world joins us in sanctioning Iran until it completely dismantles its nuclear program. Nothing we know about the Iranian government suggests that it would simply capitulate under that kind of pressure. And the world would not support an effort to permanently sanction Iran into submission. We put sanctions in place to get a diplomatic resolution, and that is what we have done. Without this deal, there would be no agreed-upon limitations for the Iranian nuclear program. Iran could produce, operate, and test more and more centrifuges. Iran could fuel a reactor capable of producing plutonium for a bomb, and we would not have any of the inspections that allow us to detect a covert nuclear weapons program. In other words, no deal means no lasting constraints on Iran's nuclear program. Such a scenario would make it more likely that other countries in the region would feel compelled to pursue their own nuclear programs, threatening a nuclear arms race in the most volatile region of the world. It would also present the United States with fewer and less effective options to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Okay, former President Obama speaking back in 2015, and you might have heard him say there that the sanctions were being used to, in the end, to achieve a diplomatic solution. So Wayne Moyer, talk about the sanctions now that will be reinstated, and what might their goal be now?
Well, what this means is that there will be severe limits on American corporations in dealing with Iran in terms both of trade and in terms of investment. And more significantly, most European businesses, since they also rely heavily on U.S. markets and work through the U.S. banking system, will be under enormous pressure to follow these sanctions. So the hope is this will have a really significant impact on the Iranian economy. I think what Trump hopes is that that will force the Iranians to make more concessions and include ballistic missiles and include their expansionist activities in other Arab countries in the negotiations. There's another argument that what Trump is really after is to try to bring down the whole Iranian regime at the moment. The country's economy is, or certainly the currency is in free fall at the moment. The problem is that if the agreement collapses and the Iranians then restart their enriching of uranium, what will the U.S. do then? And
but not to interrupt you, the deal is going to. I mean, it's ending. So this next step you're speaking, are you saying that's likely?
Well, the deal isn't completely ending because the Europeans are trying to negotiate with the Iranians and keep the deal going without the United States. And there's a question in my mind whether they can do that because the European businesses are working through the U.S. banking system and dependent on U.S. markets. If the deal goes down, then I think we'll have to see what happens then. Will the Iranians negotiate? Will the regime collapse? Will they start enriching uranium again? And then what will the U.S. do at that point? And will we feel compelled to attack Iran as the enrichment starts?
Are the sanctions that powerful? I mean, is that a real possibility to bring down the Iranian government through sanctions? And if so, was that happening before?
I think there's a real question of whether we could bring down the Iranian government. Some people argue that it is already weak and that the people hate the government and it won't take much to bring it down. Others say that the hold of the government is enormously tight, that they'll be able to repress any kind of dissent. So I think it's very questionable whether it's even possible to bring the government down with the sanctions.
And Jonathan Haseeb, what are the power of sanctions here?
Well, the power of sanctions, of course, are to pressure the Iranian economy and the currency, potentially not sell Iran things like spare parts for their aging aircraft fleet and this kind of thing. But sanctions are unlikely by themselves to work. We've had many sanctions against Iran for a long time.
It won't work to do what?
Well, they won't work to bring down the regime, certainly.
Right.
I mean, I think that's most unlikely. But I suppose they might put additional pressure on the Iranian regime to come back to the negotiating table. The problem, as we've just heard a little bit from Wayne, is that the Europeans have a slightly different agenda here, right? The Europeans like the agreement, and a lot of European companies are really hungrily eyeing the Iranian market, especially for things like aircraft, where Airbus is, I think, just delighted probably with this decision.
Well, and as we heard from former President Obama, there's a long years in the making for that agreement back in 2015. If the Iranians were forced back to the negotiating table through the use of sanctions, that may not happen tomorrow. It would be down the road, I suppose.
Right. I mean, potentially, real sanctions, I don't know, might not bite on the Iranian economy for some time. I mean, especially if major European trading partners are essentially going around them, right? I mean, one of the big pluses of the Iranian nuclear deal as it was written was that the U.S. and Europe were all on the same page with Iran, and now, of course, it's torn up. And so the Europeans are going to, France, Germany, the U.K. all have their own independent foreign policies, and it's going to make it a lot more likely for Iran potentially to play off its adversaries against each other.
Now, if Iran does whatever unfolds, if Iran does fully develop a nuclear weapon program, Wayne Moyer, compare their situation to what it means for North Korea to have a nuclear weapon, or even perhaps Pakistan.
The problem, I think, is there are a couple problems. One, the Middle East is a very volatile place. And it's more volatile than East Asia. And the possibility is if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia will want to get a nuclear weapon, and And Turkey will want to get a nuclear weapon. And the Middle East is already in such an incendiary state that further development of nuclear weapons, I think the likelihood of use of military of nuclear weapons is probably greater in the Middle East than it is in Korea. I think one comparison that I would make, though, I think Trump feels that he's brought North Korea to the negotiating table with his toughness. And I think he may well be thinking that the situation with Iran is the same game. If I'm tough, I'll bring them to the negotiating table. It's not quite so clear to me that these are totally analogous situations.
And we did hear a clip there earlier from former Secretary of State John Kerry. And we did hear that that Kerry met with an Iranian foreign minister. What of this, Jonathan Haseeb? Is John Kerry meddling in business that clearly he would want to keep his a big issue that would impact his legacy, I imagine. But is this appropriate for him to be doing that?
I mean, it probably isn't appropriate. There's something called the Logan Act, which you've heard a lot about recently, and basically it says that private citizens are not allowed to make U.S. foreign policy. It's never been, no one has ever been prosecuted under it. I can understand John Kerry, of course, wants to keep his legacy, but of course he's not Secretary of State anymore. And, he should, he's of course free and willing to make expressions of opinion as a private citizen, but to negotiate or quasi-negotiate with foreign governments is a little odd.
But and Wayne Moyer, is he setting a precedent here? Or are we going to see Rex Tillerson in a few years making international trips?
No, I don't think so. I think the meetings that I worry more about are the meetings between the Iranian foreign minister and the European foreign ministers, sort of to make their own negotiations with the Iranians and to try to keep this deal going and isolating the United States.
Okay. If you're just joining us, this is Politics Wednesday on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Just heard from Wayne Moyer from Grinnell College, also joined by Jonathan Haseeb from ISU. Well, North Korea is, of course, continuing to be in the news. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is coming back to the U.S. after going to North Korea and bringing back three U.S. citizens that had been in a North Korean labor camp. They were jailed for supposed anti-state activities. President Trump said in a tweet that they appear to be healthy and he'll be greeting them when they arrive home tomorrow afternoon. Wayne Moyer, it's a goodwill gesture before a meeting in person. Do we expect a return favor? How does this work?
Well, I think it is a goodwill gesture, and it's a good sign in terms of at least the North Korean attitude going into the negotiations. One has to ask the question, how much of this is just a public relations blitz? And to try to gain some kind of international support for the North Koreans before the negotiations start, and hence try to strengthen their bargaining position vis-a-vis the U.S.
And what is their position? I mean, what is their strength now? Do they have a lot to work with?
Their strength is that they have operational nuclear weapons, and they now have a ballistic missile. We don't know whether they have a warhead for the ballistic missile. The fact that they have both the weapon and the missile is a problem for the U.S.
And Jonathan Haseeb, update us on how what the role of China is with our relationship with the United States' relationship with North Korea, and has that been changing under the Trump administration?
I don't know that the Chinese relationship with North Korea has been changing too much. The Chinese see North Korea as basically a big strategic problem, right? So North Korea, China is North Korea's supposedly only ally. North Korea does something like 80% of all its foreign trade through China. But from the Chinese perspective, the Chinese see the North Koreans as a bunch of basically backwards hillbillies who need to enter the modern world. And from the Chinese perspective, they're propping the regime up, not because they like it, but because they consider the alternative worse. That is to say, if the North Korean regime were to collapse, potentially you'd have a reunified Korea, which would mean a U.S. ally right on the Chinese border. And that's something the Chinese very much don't want. They also don't want any potential flow of refugees if the North Korean regime collapses. And so, although there's every indication that relations between President Xi Jinping of China and President Kim Jong-un of North Korea, that the relations are not particularly warm, that they actually do not very, very much like each other. Nonetheless, From the Chinese perspective, they sort of feel that they want to denuclearize North Korean peninsula, but they also don't want to push North Korea too hard for fear that it would lose China all of its leverage, or even worse.
So in this newfound, at least beginnings of a relationship, this meeting upcoming between Kim Jong-un and President Trump, is there going to be any kind of role that China will play, do you see?
I mean, certainly the Chinese would like to play a role, but the Chinese also don't want to do it all themselves. I think if there is somehow an actual breakthrough agreement between the United States and North Korea that leaves China out, you know, the Chinese will be furious about it. Essentially, you know, China very much wants to be involved in this pie. I mean, I don't know. It's too early to tell if there will be any agreement between Trump and Kim. You know, both presidents are sort of known for their bluster, and you know, it sort of the proof will be in the pudding. I mean, there's a lot of talk. Releasing prisoners is obviously a good sign, but it's essentially purely symbolic. Doesn't cost the North Korean government anything, or hardly anything.
Go ahead. Yeah, I was just going to add a bit. I think it's significant that Kim Jong-un and President Xi have met twice in the last month, and my suspicion is that China is probably going to North Korea is totally dependent on China in terms of trade, and I suspect China is trying to use its economic leverage to sort of gently push North Korea into giving up nuclear weapons, or at least trying to reach an agreement with the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. So clearly, the Chinese want the North Korean regime to denuclearize, but you know, they don't want to push too hard to do so.
And, you know, I'm thinking back to news stories years ago, even with things that North Korean leaders may be doing in times when it seems like they're maybe kind of pulling back from some extreme positions, only to later kind of, well, then we hear about some sort of missile test. And so with this newfound beginnings of a possible relationship, at least with this meeting, Are we just going to hear in a few months again about another missile test, and it'll all be thrown out in the water? I know you don't have a crystal ball, Wayne Moyer, but I mean, is that likely given what we know about Kim Jong-un?
Well, what we know about the North Korean regime in general, they've made these commitments in terms of denuclearization before, and not testing before, and developing nuclear weapons before, and they've not kept those agreements. And so I think the critical thing on any kind of new agreement now is, can we absolutely verify the things that they say that they're doing, and will the process be such that we'll have time to respond at various stages in terms of any kind of denuclearization agreement?
Jonathan Haseeb, quickly before we move to another topic, anything to add there? Is that going to be possible to oversee that sort of thing?
I mean, verification is very, very difficult, right? If the administration thinks we have a hard time verifying Iran, a relatively open society, verification in North Korea will be extremely challenging. And so I think there's every likelihood of the North Koreans, you know, cheating on any agreement, as they have done in the past, if they feel it's in their best interest to do so.
Okay, let's move on quickly to actual votes that happened yesterday as we talk about politics during our Politics Day here on River to River. There were primary elections in a variety of states, not Iowa, but Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, North Carolina. The Republican Senate primary in West Virginia got a lot of attention because Don Blankenship, a candidate, seemed to be surging ahead of the vote. He's a former coal mining executive. He wound up spending a year in prison after mine safety regulations were ignored, and 29 people were killed. He ended up coming in third in that primary, losing to more establishment candidate, State Attorney General Patrick Morrisey. He'll be the GOP challenger to Democrat Joe Manchin. What do you take away from that race? We did hear a lot there leading up, Jonathan Haseeb, about whether this would look like another Roy Moore candidacy, if you remember from recently in Alabama. What did you take away from the results there?
The president tweeted basically yesterday, I think, saying, you know, don't vote for Blankenship, avoid him. And I don't know how much impact that have. I mean, it's hard to know. So a lot of people framed this as an establishment versus outsider kind of a race, right? That Blankenship was saying all kinds of very negative things about Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and McConnell, was saying negative things about Blankenship. But, you know, it's hard to know without more detailed information sort of to what extent these national conversations mattered inside West Virginia. It might well be that West Virginians, you know, didn't listen to any of this, right, and didn't want to vote for a guy who's, convicted of killing 29 minors. I don't know to what extent this national narrative that, like, Mitch McConnell has won here, I don't know to what extent that's accurate.
Okay, and we're going to run out of time in our segment here. But in Ohio, Rachel Crooks has accused President Trump of kissing her on the lips and on the cheek without her consent. She says that was in 2005. She's running for Ohio House District 88. She won the Democratic primary last night. She was uncontested, but here's part of her campaign ad.
Mine was a story all too common for women, so I had a choice to make. I could either keep quiet or speak up. I spoke up. I said me too.
Tonight, a growing list of women are
accusing Donald have come
Trump.
Forward to say.
And in the days that followed, many more said me too as well. Because speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have.
We can now project the winner of the
But we know what happened.
Donald Trump wins the presidency.
And it was demoralizing.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
For a moment. Then the people got to work. The women got to work. Because from a riveter named Rosie to Rosa Parks, right up to today, in America, when women are called, we show up. Organizing, building community, resisting. But I knew I had to do more than just resist. Because the people in this part of Ohio deserve better.
Okay, that Rachel Crooks, their Democratic candidate for they're in Ohio for House District 88. And Wayne Moyer, and just briefly, without going into all the details of the other races as well, we do hear that the President Trump is being talked about in these races. Are they going to keep talking about him? Is he himself going to be a campaign issue in the fall elections?
Well, I think he certainly is. I mean, you heard the Rachel side and the Democratic side. The Republican side in Indiana, in Ohio, in West Virginia, the Republican candidates who won the primaries were all large supporters for governor and senators, are all strong supporters of President Trump.
And Jonathan Hasid, quickly.
Indeed, Blankenship said that he was Trump before Trump or something, Trumpier than Trump. But, you know, he lost.
That's right. Okay, Jonathan Hasid, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University, and Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Cornell College, will stay with us in the next half of the program. Coming up, we'll be talking about the nominee to lead the CIA. Gina Haspel has been answering questions about waterboarding and torture and how she would lead the CIA. We'll look a little also at Robert Mueller's investigation in the next half of the program. It's Politics Wednesday on River to River. I'm Ben Stanton. Stay with us.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Thanks for being with us on this River to River Politics Wednesday on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton in for Ben Kiefer today, and you'll want to join us tomorrow on this program. If you're interested in the latest technology using virtual reality, you'll want to listen as we visit the Virtual Reality Application Center on the ISU campus. It's a really fascinating and world-class setup, interesting research going on. And if you don't know much about virtual reality, you'll also want to tune in and learn some of the basics as IPR's Emily Woodbury tests out some of that equipment. We'll bring that to you on tomorrow's program. But still with us on this Politics Day is Jonathan Hasid, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University, and Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Now, CIA director nominee Gina Haspel testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee this morning. Her nomination has been a little controversial because of her involvement with the enhanced interrogation program after the September 11 terrorist attacks. And here's what she had to say when she was questioned about that today.
This country has had the opportunity to reflect because we have some space. We're not fearing another attack. And we have We have deliberated about the standard we want to use in interrogations, and that is the Army Field Manual. The very important thing to know about CIA is we follow the law. We followed the law then, and we follow the law now. But I would never permit CIA to resume an interrogation program.
And Haspel would be the first career professional of the agency to rise through the ranks to that job since the 70s, and she would be the first woman to lead the CIA. Jonathan Aseed, what are the chances for Gina Haspel?
It's hard to know. Rand Paul of Kentucky has already said that he opposes her nomination. And, of course, John McCain is out, perhaps indefinitely, as he recovers from brain cancer treatment. So she would require Democratic support to be nominated. And, you know, given the partisan environment and perhaps her own background in so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, that may be a hard sell. I mean, you know, obviously her testimony will matter a great deal. We'll have to see how that what happens going forward.
That's right. And McCain's voice was, I guess, noticeably missing from that discussion, as he does have opinions about how those techniques are used or not used on those detainees.
Indeed, he is a vocal, outspoken opponent of torture. I mean, you know, by international convention, most of these things that are described are in fact torture. You know, he strongly opposes that. And so with him gone, he's not lending his voice, but of course he's also potentially not giving a vote either.
Wayne Moyer?
Well, I think for me the biggest problem with this is that she destroyed or ordered destroyed the tapes of some of the interrogations, in other words, destroying evidence in terms of what was actually done. I'm not sure that could ever have been justified as following the law. On the other hand, she's a very, very competent professional and who has the support of almost everybody else, all of the key CIA officials and a bunch of generals as well. And so you have to balance those two things together, and I agree with Jonathan. This is a close call. It's not quite clear what's going to come out of it.
And what do we know about the atmosphere at the CIA? And if she would be a career professional, you know, that would move into that role, does that matter for you know? A lot of times in other agencies, we hear about the culture that's created from top down, and do we know what that means in the CIA, Wayne Moyer?
I worry about this, and my memories go back to Vietnam, when we were worried about the head of the intelligence agency being a person from inside the intelligence community, and that there was a need to have someone from the outside who could objectively evaluate what the intelligence community was doing. And with the intelligence community normally relying so heavily on secrecy, to what extent do you want to put the top job in the hands of somebody who is part of the inner circle?
And Jonathan Aseed, maybe it would also depend on who that person from the outside would be if you were comparing them, but...
Of course. You know, in the past, a lot of outsider CIA directors have been things like generals and admirals who, although not a member of the CIA, of course, have been privy to national secrets and, of course, have lots of experience running sort of large quasi-military organizations. So, you know, that matters. You know, if Trump were to appoint somebody totally unqualified, right, it would be a different matter than appointing a qualified outsider.
Well, we've seen a lot of confirmation hearings as the administration sort of shuffles around, so I'm not sure if you're watching more of those sorts of things these days, both of you gentlemen, but what are we seeing in those confirmation hearings more broadly? Is there a different attitude towards these nominees? And maybe they're not coming in faster than they have been in the past, but it seems like they're getting maybe more attention. Jonathan Aseed?
There has been quite a bit more turnover in the White House, right? So we've already gone through two Secretary of State hearings, right, with Rex Tillerson and Mike Pompeo. So there do seem to be more of these hearings. But also, of course, the American partisan environment is so toxic now that there's, I think, a lot more posturing. In the past, the Senate generally has given deference to presidential nominees for cabinet-level positions, and now some of that deference is gone, and there's more and more challenge.
Wayne Moyer?
Well, one of the things that I will be watching is when Tillerson was Secretary of State, there were a large number of senior offices in the Department of State that were not filled. So there's a big gap in the top levels of the State Department. And will now, with Pompeo as Secretary of State, will we see a big effort to appoint those positions? And, of course, each of the top-level positions will require a Senate confirmation hearing.
Hey, you're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. We want to hear your voice. Are you interested in chiming in on any of these political issues we're covering on River to River today? 866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference with the 2016 election has maybe hit a few bumps. Last year seemed to be, well, brisk and maybe prolific with indictments and plea deals. And now, you know, two federal judges have questioned the authority of the investigation relating to those matters that are not directly associated with the investigation the Russian interference in the election, including crimes that former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort has been accused of. Jonathan Aced, is this idea real? Mueller facing some resistance?
He's facing perhaps a little bit of resistance. I would be very surprised if the general mandate that he has gotten from the Justice Department and from Rodenstein, the Assistant Attorney General, I would be shocked if that were overturned by a higher-level court. But around the margins, there does seem to be some pushback in the judiciary. The latest example seems to be related to Robert Mueller's indictment last year or maybe earlier this year of the 13 Russians who were accused of sort of conspiring in the U.S. election. That was probably sort of a grandstanding kind of indictment, but now it's being challenged in U.S. court, and it may well be outside of his purview, but I don't think it'll affect the core of the Mueller investigation.
Affecting, though, public perception, which I take it would be a piece of the puzzle, perhaps, and the president doing his part to try to throw water on it.
Certainly, yeah, of course. I mean, any time that you sort of get yelled at by a judge in public, it's potentially humiliating, and of course, President Trump, with the world's loudest megaphone, will do everything he can to try to discredit this investigation at every opportunity. So you're right that it might matter in the court of public opinion, but in a legal court, I think the results will be pretty limited.
And Wayne Mueller, is this any overreach you see here?
I don't see overreach. I agree with Jonathan. This has become highly political, and the people who favor the investigation obviously are going to play this down completely, and the people who are opposed to the Mueller's work are going to play it up as far as its significance is concerned. I think judicially it probably is not going to make a lot of difference.
What can either of you tell us about special prosecutors, special counsels going back in history, and what their role has been, and does it tend to change, and there's certain rules about what they can, ancillary issues that they can investigate and these kinds of things, but it often does get a lot of public attention. What does history tell us? There's been a number of special prosecutors over the years. Is their role always appropriate? Jonathan Aced.
Sometimes they do seem to sort of go beyond their mandate. So, of course, the most prominent example of that was Ken Starr's investigation of Whitewater, which went on for 4 years. And so the investigation was originally based on potentially corrupt land dealings in Arkansas, but, of course, ended up impeaching then-President Bill Clinton for perjury because of this sexual encounter he had with Monica Lewinsky, which I think any fair-minded person would agree is way beyond his remittance, his mandate. But special prosecutors, depending on how their brief is written, potentially can follow crimes where they find them. And that is the way that Robert Mueller's brief has been written by the Justice Department. It says sort of anything pertaining to anything that comes up in the course of these investigations is potentially fair game. So we have seen special counsels, perhaps stretch a bit before. And so there is some precedent for this.
Wayne Mueller?
I would take it at even another level. I mean, the prosecutors in general, in the process of investigating a case, often come up with other information that then may affect that case, but may bring all sorts of other things under judicial review as well. It's just when you start digging into things, sometimes you come up with all sorts of other things that will require legal attention.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to when the appointment of Robert Mueller was going on, and there was so much discussion about, well, how long will it take, and will we start seeing some information come out from that investigation? And then so many experts said, oh, wait, he's likely to be a year out before we are really getting to the meat of what he'll be looking into. So what do you think here, roughly a year later, gentlemen, are any end in sight? Or is it so hard to tell, of course, without having all the information that Robert Mueller might have? But what kind of cues are we hearing that might indicate what point we're at here? Jonathan, Wayne Morey, go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things that strikes me is with the campaign coming up, and I'm not quite sure what the rules on it. Jonathan may know this better than I do, but I understand that Mueller will not be able to say anything at a certain stage in the campaign because that would be interfering in the political campaign. But I'm not sure of that.
I think that's right. I mean, I'm not a legal expert, so I'm not entirely sure. But I think that's correct.
And well, there's, of course, optics, as we may have seen in the past, of when certain information comes out that's supposedly from a nonpartisan source that then maybe appears partisan, maybe because of the context and timing, thinking, of course, to James Comey's information there just days before the 2016 presidential election. Any thoughts there? Wayne Moyer?
Well, that's, from my point of view, is a violation. That was inserting himself into a political campaign.
Okay. You can join our conversation on River to River, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or email, I guess, at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Well, as we kind of hinted at earlier, gentlemen, Senator John McCain has been meeting with friends and colleagues at his home in Arizona, including former Vice President Joe Biden. But McCain's health has been declining since he announced he had an aggressive brain cancer. And apparently, McCain was saying he doesn't want President Trump to go to his eventual funeral and that he would want Vice President Mike Pence to attend that eventual event instead. And then Senator Orrin Hatch said that McCain should reconsider inviting Trump. Later, Hatch apologized for that, said he spoke out of turn. But we again, touched on it earlier, but Jonathan Nassib, John McCain and the president have a strained relationship, fair to say that?
Indeed. Of course, as you'll recall, during the campaign, President Trump said that, you know, he appreciated Americans who hadn't been captured, right? And he sort of impugned McCain's patriotism and all kinds of things. I mean, I think it's clear that there's a lot of personal animosity between the two.
And Wayne Moyer?
Well, this goes back to the Vietnam War. McCain was a pilot who was captured and held in captivity, and Trump avoided military service.
And again, with McCain's absence at the Capitol, what do we know about the prospects of? Of course, there's so much attention about a year ago when McCain was a deciding vote on a few issues. And with his absence, are we seeing that? There hasn't been a lot of major legislation moving forward like it was in a way last summer. But are we feeling his absence there, Wayne Moyer?
I think we are. I think the main place, and we alluded to it earlier, is in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. You don't have his vote. And I believe the committee then is evenly balanced between Democrats and Republicans without him, or it's within one vote. So he does make a significant difference.
And we like to call
that level.
He likes to call himself a maverick, and he kind of steps outside of traditional rank and file roles in the Republican Party. And as we were talking a little earlier about Rand Paul, also. Sort of goes his own way, but is there now a void to fill that the likes of Rand Paul and others might step into? Is that a politically good idea, Jonathan Haseeb?
I think given the way the Republican Party is today, you'll notice that the only people sort of going their own way and speaking out on things that they disagree with are people who are retiring, like Bob Corker, or people who have, very serious, potentially fatal health problems, like John McCain. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of room in the Republican Party for people who, let's say, disagree with, the head of the party, right, with President Trump. These people are, either sort of politically leaving or otherwise unavailable, and I don't think that's a coincidence. So it's unlikely that we're going to sort of fill the sort of metaphorical shoes of John McCain anytime soon.
Let's talk for a few minutes, gentlemen, about the nation's voting systems. And we hear a lot about, of course, what was going on in the 2016 elections and that the apparently the Russians were attempting in many ways to influence campaigns and the elections. There were a number of attempted hacks, including Iowa's system was apparently attempted, but they say no breach of that system happened. And people are looking ahead now to the fall elections and whether there would be motivation for the Russians to keep doing it. Wayne Moyer, any reason to think that the Russians won't try again to influence the election in that way?
Oh, I'm sure that they will try to hack in and probably will be successful in hacking in. And so what I think is most important, that there be some kind of hard copy, if you would, of people's voting records that can then be checked after the election rather than just a plain voting machine that you can't show after the fact for sure how a person actually voted. And I think the big question there is, will there be enough money and enough time to change the system fast enough?
Well, it's a little disturbing. You sound so confident that they will be successful, and I guess I have no reason not to believe that, but that would be concerning, I think, for a lot of voters. How should we be viewing our elections, regardless of the paper backup system?
Well, my sense is that just like each of us in our own individual computers, there is no computer that is safe from hacking, and we need to take whatever precautions we can.
Any additional thoughts there, Jonathan?
I mean, one thing to remember is that, the United States doesn't have one voting system, right? It has at least 51, the states plus the District of Columbia, and so any one of them can be potentially targeted by Russians or any other kind of hackers. And so, it's not just a matter of securing one central system, which is already incredibly difficult or perhaps impossible, but securing, 51 separate systems, which is, I'm glad I'm not doing it.
That's right. That's right. And in the few minutes we have remaining, did want to try to touch just briefly on a state issue that came out of Iowa recently. The abortion ban, the fetal heartbeat bill, was signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds and receiving a lot of attention across the country. And we've talked about this issue many times on the show in the past, but now that that's kind of playing out in the public sphere, what do we know, Jonathan Haseeb, about how this will go forward and how people will view this issue come the fall?
Sure. I mean, abortion is always, of course, a big issue for a lot of voters. In terms of the actual bill that was signed, the most restrictive in the country, I don't imagine that it will survive judicial challenge. Similar bills have been struck down many times in the past, and the makeup of the Supreme Court has not changed enough that something like this would be a vehicle to overturn Roe v. Wade. So essentially, the state is just sort of wasting millions of dollars to make a political point. Which at a time of massive budget cuts is, a little galling that they would choose to do this.
Wayne Moyer?
It seems to me it's just the result of political posturing to try to gain political points to get this passed, because I agree with Jonathan. It doesn't have a chance of being a remaining in force after court challenge.
But then again, political points are political points. And when you're a politician and you say you're going to run on an issue and you're elected and then you make that legislation happen, then those people that voted you in are happy.
right, and then other people are unhappy. So how will it turn out?
That's true. Always true, I suppose, with any issue. But we're running out of time for our program today. But thank you, Jonathan Aseed, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Wayne Moyer, thank you for being here, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. We had production assistance today from Natalia Reyes, Dennis Reese, and John Free in Ames. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. For Ben Kiefer, I'm Ben Stanton. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.